Blog Talk Radio.
God bless you wherever you are in the world. You are with us on Blog Talk Radio and The Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson, and with me are my friends and co-hosts, Crystalline Beek Larson and Andre Rodatis. Good morning, you guys.
Good morning.
Good
day,
morning. I feel like saying Vietnam.
Good morning. Oh, you're funny.
Well, thank goodness we're not in the Far East, because it would be the middle of the night if we were.
That's right.
Maybe. I mean, midnight probably, or 1 a.m. So we are go ahead.
Just feeling like Robin Williams, I guess. I don't know. It's just
you
one
are
of those.
Perky, Mr.
Yeah, what is it? Just I got 45 minutes sleep in the last 12 hours, so what the heck?
Maybe it's not perky. Maybe it's more like
maybe it's punchy.
Yeah, punchy.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, we are in the second series of a show that we really enjoy. We enjoyed last week, and it's a topic, of course, that's near and dear to our hearts because we've come to this problem from different perspectives and with different experiences. And, of course, we want to hear from all of you about this, too. If you want to call in, the number is 646-716-8158. What we're talking about is creating a spiritual culture in your family. And, can you share the teachings of the Urantia book with your family and friends, and especially with your children, the most important people to the future, obviously, are the next generation coming up. And we all have experienced that some Urantia book readers think, no, you can't, or you shouldn't. You shouldn't put a, quote, ready-made religious experience on them. But is that what it really is, to share what you know about God, to share your concepts of God and creation and the universe with your children? I don't think it is. I think it's a parental duty to share those greater concepts of God. And I feel like if we don't do it, then somebody else, some other influential person is going to come along and do it, and the outcome may not be as good as certainly what we've learned about our loving Creator from the Urantia book. So we have some friends that are going to call in, and we want to just explore in the book what it says about this topic in various places, what it says about creating spiritual family culture, the responsibility of parents within the family to teach these lessons of God and the universe. And Crystalline would like to start with a recap of what the first two epical revelations The first one being Dalmatia, the root revelation, as I call it, like the root chakra. It's the root revelation, the root of civilization. And it's the first, all important. I think it's the red revelation. Personally, I think they line up with the chakras really well, and the colors. And then also the second revelation, which was Adam and Eve, and what they did to bring us forward in enriching our family life. So, Krislyn, go ahead. Let's hear what you where you wanted to start here.
Well, I want to start, first of all, just by saying, for anyone who's listening who would like to call in to talk about the topic, you can call in to 646-716-8158. And if you do call in and you get on the air with us, please remember to turn down the sound on your computer so that we're not getting the reverb while we are listening to you.
What made you remember that?
Last week we had like a Pink Floyd echo chamber on
okay.
on the show. So it was psychedelic, but you know, I hope it was entertaining. It was interesting.
I kind of liked it.
So, thank you, Krislyn, for that reminder. We do have. It's like our friend Andre Traverse used to say. It's live radio, folks. Sometimes this is what you get. So we thank our listeners for bearing with us on that.
We don't have like a 10-second tape delay, do we? There's nobody editing in the background, making sure
no.
we don't have goofs and gaffes.
We don't even have somebody who filters calls. I mean, if you call, you'll probably get on. Sometimes it takes a little patience, I know, but we try to get you on as soon as we can. So again, do give us a call if you want to talk about what you've done specifically to create a family culture of spirituality, or if you've had an experience where you just said, wow, it was just impossible. If you find that you are married to a spouse who really doesn't want you to say anything about your spiritual beliefs in your family or to your children, you know, these are all valid experiences, and we want to share them. We all need to get better at this. So sometimes we feel apologetic, and I can understand that. I mean, you know, I've met people who have lost their jobs, been kicked out of their church, ended up divorced because of the Urantia book, because of their beliefs about God. As strange as that sounds in this day and age, with the great barrage of information we have coming in all around us all the time, people still get deeply prejudiced concerning their religious beliefs. So Krislyn, go ahead.
Well, that is also one of the topics that we want to get into more depth about, how to share your ideals if they differ from your spouse's. Anyway, one of the places to start on the first epical revelation is that the prince's staff, the original prince's staff, part of their intention or what they were here to do was to upgrade the order of family life. And even though they didn't have their own children, they said never less than 500 adopted children. Many were orphans, and some were apparently sent just to live with them, to learn. And they were basically given over to these sort of super parents. And that's just a concept that I thought was intriguing, that, you know, there was some sort of foster care or parental training that children were getting in Dalmatia. Or at least that's the way I read it.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Just to read, it says, the definite order of family life and the living of one family together in one residence of comparatively settled location date from these times of Dalmatia and were chiefly due to the example and teachings of the 100 and their pupils. The home as a social unit never became a success until the supermen and superwomen of Dalmatia led mankind to love and plan for their grandchildren and their grandchildren's children. Savage man does love his child, but civilized man loves also his grandchild.
Well, I love that because last week we definitely touched on, and in my experience, it's so important, on how essential a grandparent can be to a child's spiritual life and to their upbringing, to their moral life, to their philosophical life. I used to sit up, I would go to my grandmother's house. Her house was like a bastion of peace for me. It was a little slice of heaven on earth. And I felt like with her I could be who I was. I didn't have to be anybody else. She loved me just the way I was. And a little kind of corny kid with a big heart. And I see this in my grandson, you know, and my grandchildren, so it's really touching. But, I mean, literally, we would sit up late at night and read poetry to each other. Now, how many kids do you know thrill to do that? I would look forward to it. And she recognized in me a sensitivity and a person that other people didn't see. And it was so precious to be able to share that person openly with her without feeling embarrassed or, you know, silly. And, it was pivotal to me in my life to have that. And I look back on it and reflect many times how grateful I am. And I still oftentimes dream about my grandmother's house. And in my dream, I get it back. I buy it back. You know, those of you who like to, you know, take apart dreams, I buy it back. And I know that from the dream study I have heard, dreams of houses are always dreams of yourself. So clearly, to me, it's a part of myself that I love. But it just goes to show, and it's something that oftentimes I think we hesitate to openly share our spirituality with others because we feel, I don't know, vulnerable, silly, I said corny. You know, what do you think it is, you guys? Why do you think we ever hold back sharing our real selves with others, especially our spiritual selves?
Wow.
Well, if we've been ridiculed or put down or in some way made to feel less than okay, when we've shared those sorts of sensitive feelings when we've been young, I think that sort of primes us for being embarrassed or uncomfortable about sharing real deep thoughts as we get older. And I think certain family cultures are more supportive of kids, you know, sharing their insights and more respectful of children and their ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's something we haven't touched on at all, is those families who totally abhor any talk of the spirit in their home. It's almost like I've literally talked to people who said it was like you know, saying Jesus was like saying a four-letter word. But sorry, Andre, go ahead. I know you wanted to say
something. No, not at all. I think that's very important to get out. To me, that's astounding. I was talking to a friend this week, and the idea of being able to talk about God and your family at a young age, I think I took for granted. My friend took for granted. I think we all did. Because even whether you grew up with the Urantia book or you were about to, you know, find it later in life, you know, some of what set us up, for being predisposed to searching in the first place was the idea that, number one, we grew up in a God-friendly atmosphere. That's not true of everybody who found the Urantia book. I'm not trying to make that equation, because I know that there are many, many stories that have led people. But I know that for me, in terms of finding the Urantia book and being predisposed to, I mean, there was never a time that I didn't believe in God in my life. And that's just, I just look at that as one of the beautiful facts of my life. I don't mean that in any kind of special way, other than I feel extraordinarily blessed at this point, knowing how others have grown up. And yet, even with that, I didn't grow up with quite the same feeling. I mean, you can look at what's lacking in your upbringing too. And somehow, even with that kind of talk about God atmosphere at home, I was really ashamed to talk about my beliefs with other people. And and I don't know where I got that, except that I was also taught in my home to worry about what other people thought. So that those two ideas didn't necessarily go together. Yeah, that didn't go together too well. But what was a fascinating experience for me as a young kid? I used to take my sister to ballet. It was my job as eldest son to do whatever had to be done that my mom couldn't do or wouldn't do or my dad wasn't able to do. So somehow, and don't ask me how this happened, but at some point, my sister was enrolled in ballet classes, and fine, she was going to have to go to ballet. And I guess sometimes she must have gotten a drive down. I don't have a real clear memory of this. But at one point, somehow as a seven-year-old, I was assigned to ride on a bus to downtown Kitchener, which was my hometown, Kitchener, Waterloo, Ontario, and to go from Waterloo to Kitchener on a bus with my sister in all kinds of weather. It didn't matter what. And get her to ballet class, and when I did, there was a Guatemalan Canadian woman there with her young daughter, and I just remember how freely she talked about being Roman Catholic, and I couldn't believe it. It just astonished me. Because we were talking about things like this last week, and I was just thinking back to my own upbringing. It took me a while before I could really talk about my beliefs with other people and feel really comfortable with them, other than feeling that I really was evangelizing or proselytizing or doing something that maybe I shouldn't be doing. But that opened my eyes to a different way of being, and so it's interesting what kinds of experiences take us out of what our family culture teaches us and how ingrained things become in us because of what we're taught in our family culture. But I'm so thankful for how the idea of God was inculcated and that God was a loving God, even though God was a God that always saw what you were doing. I probably could have done without that thought, because that obsessed me. I still think about the universe broadcast and the fact that we're somehow on universe TV. That still grabs my attention. So,
well, know, when the authors of the Arantia book tell you what Peter was thinking, there really are no secrets in the universe.
No,
you know,
no, there's no secrets,
but
and so there's
we're all open,
factual,
no matter how.
Yeah, but they're not. You know, they know when you are sleeping. They know when you're awake. They know when you've been bad or good. So be good, for goodness sake. You know, it's not that kind of Santa Claus, God, or universe. Thank goodness. They're very understanding for how we are.
Well, and you know, I noticed we have some callers on the board, but nobody has their hand up. So if you callers, I just want to tell you, if you want to give us a talk, go ahead and put your hand up there.
Well,
so, you know,
and,
go ahead, Crystal.
Well, I was going to say that when you read through the first epical revelation, one of the other things that stands out, too, is that they did present a moral code. They did teach a moral code or a moral law. And in the topic of, you know, not presenting to your children a ready-made religion, which we read that quote last week, maybe we should read it again if anybody has that handy. I'm in a different part of the book right now, so it would be helpful if you might want to pull that out and read it again. But there are other places where it says, you know, it's really the family responsibility to teach religion. And the Arantia book talks about religion as being a personal relationship with God, as differentiated from evolutionary religions, which are a set of codes and rules. But it also states that the Dalmatia 100 taught I'll just read here. Hap presented the early races with a moral law. This code was known as, quote, the Father's Way, unquote, and consisted of the following seven commandments. You shall not fear nor serve any god but the Father of all. 2. You shall not disobey the Father's Son, the world's ruler, nor show disrespect to his superhuman associates. 3. You shall not speak a lie when called before the judges of the people. 4. You shall not kill men, women, or children. 5. You shall not steal your neighbor's goods nor cattle. 6. You shall not touch your friend's wife. 7. You shall not show disrespect to your parents or to the elders of the tribe. This was the law of Dalmatia for almost 300,000 years, and many of the stones on which this law was inscribed now lie beneath the waters of the shores of Mesopotamia and Persia. It became the custom to hold one of these commandments in mind for each day of the week, using it for salutations at mealtime Thanksgiving.
Oh. Hi, you shall not touch your neighbor's wife. Just wanted to get that. Just saying.
Well, isn't it good to know that at least the cattle stealing has gone down quite a bit since then?
It is, but you know, not to make light of law. We know that liberty is made possible because of law. And that, you know, as Jesus said in his great discourse on law and liberty, if one man is to be perfectly free, then another will be a perfect slave. And liberty is made possible because of law. So, you know, let's face it, we need those things, and it's a moral code. We need a moral code. We need to teach a moral code.
So if we were to pull together, you know, a moral code for our family. You know, if we were to determine, you know, what are our 7 commandments or our 10 commandments or our whatever our family moral code is, what do we believe would be known as the Father's way or God's way in our lives or in our family culture? What are the things that we would want to pass along to our kids? I know that for me, I was greatly influenced by the work of the authors of a book called Redirecting Children's Misbehavior. And in that book, they presented, you know, that there were 2 really critical things to teach our children if they were to be good, if they were going to grow up to be good citizens. And one thing was respect for self. The other thing was respect for others. That both of those things were equally important in rearing good citizens.
Well, we have a couple of callers. Can you hold that thought for a minute, Crystalline, and we'll put some of our callers on. Area code 303, you're in my home state. You're with us on the Cosmic Citizen.
Hi, it's Miranda.
Hi, Miranda.
Hi, Miranda.
Good to have you on.
Good morning, Miranda.
Hi. Glad to be here and love the subject.
I know this is a topic dear to your heart, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, as our family, all 5 kids and everybody, we've been trying to do this, making a moral code that still allows the children to develop their own personal relationship with God and their own personal moral code, but still, you know, uphold some high standards that we all, you know, have as a family and for each other. And I mean, the ones that we've come up with over the last year, respect is one of the big ones. And that, just like you said, respect for yourself and respect for others. And then knowing that we have an equality, we all share a divine spark within us, and we each have individual talents and knowledge and different given abilities, and that we, you know, have to treat each other as equal and respect each other as all divine beings, as well as, you know, humans with individual talents. And that goes for our family and everybody else that we come in contact with, and is a super important thing. And then, of course, values are, you know, we have our main values, the fruits of the spirit ones in particular. We even have them painted on the wall so that it is almost like a every day of the week kind of thing
family
where we're looking
system.
At it. Yep, family values. And, I mean, the fruits of the spirit are what every human or what every God-believing person or being is supposed to be working on and showing forth in their life every day. So as a family, we felt it was important enough to hold each other accountable and, you know, ourselves for especially those values. Those are not very many, but they're the really important ones. You know, they were put in the Bible, they were put in the Urantia book for good reason, and anybody that does concentrate on those fruits of the Spirit and is trying to live them, you know, people certainly see them as a good person, and it's somebody that people want to be around. And if you could pick your family, it would be people that concentrate on those. So as a family, we feel those are very important. But there are like 50 values that we've mapped out that are more, some of them fit in the same categories with the fruits of the spirit values, and they're just little offshoots of them and stuff. But basically there's about 50 values that we found that all lead towards being a more loving person. And those are ones that we try to spend an entire week as a family you know, working on and talking about each one and trying to just understand what it means to develop good character and good relationships, and knowing that you developing your own character and yourself being the best person you can be is what's going to affect your relationships and everything that you do. So our family spends a lot of time on that. And then truth-seeking is our other one that we've come up with, and that that we try to seek the truth in as many places as possible and respect it, and, you know, coming from other people, and that a goal is to have your own individual truth that feels truth to you, and spending time on that spiritual search and talking to other people and just studying as many different things as you can are very important things. And then spending time with God and prayer and meditation are super important for your truth-seeking process too. So those are the things that our family kind of came up with as our basic moral code so far. And the people that are around us too, we also, you know, have sort of a rules for our household about not using drugs and alcohol, and especially at our house and stuff. And those kind of things were things the kids helped come up with, and we came up with as basic things that we feel, you know, make our family wholesome and our household wholesome, and help just lay some basic things for anybody that's staying with us or, you know, wants to know who we are.
Well, we all know you, so we're at a disadvantage in a way, because we know your children. And so for our listeners, give us a quick overview of your family, Miranda. Your children and their ages would be nice.
My kids are 10, 9, 5, and 2 and a half. And then we have a 16-year-old foster daughter that lives with us, too. And
wow.
I grew up with the Urantia Book teachings. My mom, I grew up with sort of a mixture of stuff. My family joined the Mormon church when I was 5 years old. So my mom would kind of say, you know, every moral question was, do you want to know what the Mormons believe? Do you want to know what the Urantia Book says? Do you want to know what your dad and I believe? So she really raised us in a way of seeking our own truth, and, you know, never just gave me one answer. It was always, you need to pick what's truth for you. So that was definitely, looking back on it now, I think a good way to do things. And we kind of try to be that same way too. Just, you know, there's not one ultimate truth. You guys got to find it. But there are some things that are definitely make you a better person, and focusing on some of those are going to, you know, help you out in life if you can learn that early about respecting people and developing values and character and all that.
Well, I have a question for you. When we talk about developing self-respect as well as respect for others, what do you think is a good way to teach children self-respect? Or we can get into how you teach a child to respect others too, but just to begin with, how do you think one can help a child develop self-respect?
Well, I mean, love is the most important thing, and not putting your own judgments on your children is really important. And I think just letting, you know, any parent that pays close attention to what their child's, you know, talents that they're born with, that they're just automatically more gifted in, and trying to encourage that and really, like, point it out to children that even if they have struggles in school, helping point out the talents that they do have and really foster those so that they develop a sense of self-esteem early, and they know, you know, I might not be the best math student, but I am really great at art and really great at running or whatever it is. And then, I mean, above all, they know that, you know, the parents are going to be giving them unconditional love, even if they are bad at math, or even if, you know, they make a mistake and aren't honest and get caught for that and get in trouble, or, you know, just just letting them know that nobody's perfect and they're going to be loved no matter what they are, what they become, and just fostering that, letting them, building that self-esteem for their talents, and, you know, helping teach that they are, you know, that there is a piece of them that's a divine piece of the Father that's there to help them, and that we have infinite potential, and that all they have to do is believe in that and grasp onto it. And I feel that, I mean, taking that kind of a look and speaking to your kids that way from the beginning really works really well. My kids are very confident, very loving. They're the first ones to take in other kids at school that are the new kids and befriend them. One of my sons stood up to a bully and told him basically, you know, I don't know why you do this. I don't know why you're telling people that they're stupid or that they're ugly. He's like, but in later on in life, if you keep doing that kind of stuff, you're going to end up with no friends and your family won't even want to be around you. And he's like, you know, if you want to talk to me about why you feel like you have to treat people that way. And now that kid is one of his best friends. So it was very cool to see kind of stuff that the kids even can realize that some other kids are at a disadvantage, and that disadvantage sometimes is just that their parents aren't talking to them about the same kind of stuff and telling them how, you know, I mean, he wasn't afraid to tell that kid, there's a wonderful part of you inside of you, and you just need to let the other stuff go, stop being mean to people, and develop the wonderful side of you. And it was just like, what?
Well, Mommy must have been real proud when she heard that story.
I was.
Well, that's about it. That's about family culture, too, and he obviously learned that in his own family and felt comfortable teaching it then as a result. And what I heard you say, which I think is just invaluable, and I touched on it when I shared what my grandmother gave to me, that is, get to know your children, get to know them. You said you're a parent who pays attention to their gifts and their natural abilities, and love them for who they are, a unique being. Don't make them who you think they should be. In other words, my dad was a doctor, I want you to be a doctor. You know, that kind of thing. Love them for their gifts and their abilities and for who they are. And to do that, just like anybody, you know, the Arantia book tells us, if we're going to fall in love with people, we have to get to know them. Well, we have to get to know our own children, too. Sometimes, you know, they're a mix of a gene pool that's drawing from many different, you know, pools. And they're not going to be the people that we thought. Maybe they're more like the other side of the family. It doesn't matter. Love them for who they are. And bring out the best in them and let them, and also help them. You know, sometimes they don't have a natural ability with something, but they can gain knowledge. You know, not every kid is born knowing how to read. I don't know any kid that's born knowing how to read. We have to teach them that. Some of them have more of a propensity for that. Some of them have less. Still, you can give them the confidence that they can learn to read, even if it's difficult. You know, so that's part of it, too. Letting them know that it's that these things that are difficult, even challenging, that take effort, they're worth it, and they can do it. You know, having them believe in themselves enough to know that even if something's very difficult, you can still learn how to do it.
And that it's worth the effort.
And it's
the other thing too that's intriguing to me is the quote later on in the Jesus Papers about how Jesus would stop at nothing to restore the self-esteem in those who had lost it and to restrain it in those who had too much.
Mm-hmm.
That, or I guess it's self-respect.
Yeah.
One is about respecting yourself and one is about respecting others, really, isn't it? I mean, they're both right there. One is about respecting yourself and the other is about respecting others. If you have too much self-respect, sometimes you can tend to be disrespectful of others.
Yeah, I mean, pride is one thing that is sort of, in some schools and stuff, I think you're taught to be proud of what you do or you know, pride is just, is sort of one of those values almost that is there, a very tricky one.
Mm-hmm.
Having self-respect and self-discovery and all that kind of stuff is really good and healthy things, but when it turns towards pride is when it can become very dangerous.
Right.
And actually, there's like 18 references in the Urantia book against being prideful.
Exactly.
And
I think that's
yeah,
a great,
so,
great thing to have brought up.
Yes.
Yeah, and the kids, having
it's a
those discussions
sword.
With your, yeah, having those discussions with your kids too, so that they know the difference between respecting yourself and developing your self-esteem, yet not becoming prideful and knowing, you know, staying humble and knowing that God is, you know, giving you a lot of those gifts and that all the time you should be trying to be a more loving person and appreciating what God has given you, but not being proud that, oh, I have all these accomplishments and you don't kind of stuff is, you know, that's where you can become very dangerous, or thinking that you know more than others. And just, I mean, a lot of it is by example, and a lot of teaching done by parents is by the children look at what you're loyal to and what how you act. And if you are pointing out the faults of others and being prideful and saying you're way better than others, or that your religion is, you know, knows the truth but other people don't, or any of that kind of stuff, your kids are going to end up acting exactly the same way. But if you come from a place of love and respect and, you know, and standing up for not being prideful and standing up for not talking bad about other people or saying that you're better, then your kids end up, you know, being raised the same way and acting the same way because that's what they've seen. That's the pattern that they've seen you be. So, you know, it's an extremely important thing to never act in one way and think that your kids are going to turn out differently. They're either going to turn out in a different way than you, but lose respect for you because you're trying to tell them to be something different than how you're acting.
Miranda, I invite you to hold on with us. We've got another caller from New Hampshire. I'd like to put them on, too. Hold on. Hello, New Hampshire. You're with us on The Cosmic Citizen.
No, my name is New Hampshire.
You're New Hampshire now. It sounds like Lou.
Hi, Lou.
Can you hear me all right? I'm not sure about the battery strength of my hands-free device here.
Well, I can.
You're
hear
okay.
You.
You're a little muted, but not much. You're good.
Okay. This is a great topic, and I want to put forth a theory of mine.
Okay.
It's a very hopeful theory, although it grows out of perhaps something that's missing. I think all of us, or many of us, sense that a great many children are raised with either no religious tradition whatsoever or a negative, antagonistic attitude from their parents about religion in general.
Mm-hmm.
And I have this theory about these kids because it's a very hopeful theory. I think the a combination of the leadings of the Spirit and the workings of the worship adjutant, I think these influences are tireless, and their influence is almost irrepressible except by a deliberate act of will to turn away from such feelings. And I think eventually these kids who might not have been raised in a tradition of God and a religion will eventually turn to Him. And when they do, I call it, they're going to find God without the garbage, because they're going to have come to Him on their own terms and through their own seekings and quenching their own thirsts and hungers. And so I'm very hopeful, even because kids, and I think we all see this, more and more kids are raised without God. And I have sort of a little story here to back this up. I had a niece whose father came from a divorced home. His father is a devout atheist, and she just grew up with nothing in terms of God. But she came home from college. I was there with my cousin. she came home from college one day and apparently had been visiting with a family whom she observed would say grace before a meal. And she had never seen this before. And then they took her to church with them on Sunday. She had never been there before. And she came back and asked her father about this. And he was very negative about the whole church religion thing. But it led her on her own to learn more about religion and God. And I think there's a perfect example of someone who discovers there's something missing in their life and then goes out on their own to sort of fill the void. There's my theory, and I'm sticking by it.
Well, and to take that one step further, imagine then how beautiful it is to grow up in a culture where there's an acknowledgement of those great divine realities, and it's on a daily basis, and you feel comfortable. Like I'm hearkening back to Debbie Bartman calling us last week and what she said about she grew up so secure about God that she could go literally to any church and feel at home there and feel able to sort out what they know and what their understanding is and be okay and tolerant of that and accepting of that, and yet at the same time still be able to share her faith, to find a way to share her faith in a non-threatening way. And so I think, you know, I take your point very well, that God is in all of us, and if there is a desire, that God will find a way. And these great spiritual agencies, as you pointed out, the adjutant mind spirits, the angels, the mother spirit, the ministry of the spirit of truth, we will find God. And if we do experience that, we will know it for what it is. We will know God for what He is. And you know, that's such a good point. I don't think we should despair. You know, it's just interesting to me. What's more concerning to me sometimes about what people teach about God is this idea that, you know, if I share my God with you, you're going to beat me up. You know. And you're going to tell me, well, that's not how God is, and you're going to hell. That, to me, is what, you know, our and even in our national dialogue, instead of reminding each other, let's have faith, let's pray, let's trust in the goodness of humanity, in the goodness of God, we can do this, we can get through this. A catastrophe happens and someone jumps up and says, God is punishing you because you have gay marriage, you know, or something like that. The national discourse is the first thing that comes out or pops out is the person who wants to say, again, you're being punished because God doesn't like you, instead of having it just the opposite. And this, of course, can be part of a family culture as well. The discourse is, you know, that bad things happen to you, my child, because you're not a good person, or it's okay, my child, dust yourself off, pick yourself up. We can do this.
You know, I want to make a few comments. I learned a few things about Andre today, that he's the oldest son and I'm an oldest son, and that there was never a time in his life when he didn't believe in God, except for a few hedonistic college years. That's probably true for me as well.
Me too.
I grew up in a very Catholic home, and we said grace, and Dad knelt down with us at our beds, and we said goodnight prayers, and we went to church, and that was all good, okay? But it wasn't until first grade, and I went to school, and the nuns started formally teaching me about the nature of God, that I just lit up like a Christmas tree. There was nothing more obvious to me than the fact of God. It was just, no one had to convince me of anything. It's like, This truth resonated right through every fiber of my being, and it was just so obvious. It was just so obvious. So from that school, at the age of 10, I went to a Catholic military academy where we went to Mass four mornings a week. We sang high Gregorian Masses. I was a Grand Knight of the Altar. I could say a Latin Mass as an altar boy to this day.
I could say a Latin mass and not miss a syllable. We had two retreats a year. We had novenas. We had 40 hours devotions. We had Stations of the Cross. We had all this ritualistic stuff that comes with Catholicism. And then from there, I go to a Jesuit prep school where I'm taught by the most intelligent theologians in the world, the Jesuits. And again, I was going to Mass like every day, sometimes twice a day, sometimes receiving communion twice a day, which you're not supposed to do. But I was just steeped in this Catholic tradition. So here's the point I want to make. When I discovered the Urantia book, and I got this expanded theology, this expanded cosmology, this expanded knowledge of the nature of God and the government and hierarchy and order of the universe, it didn't cause me to hate the church, even though it pointed out where the church's theology was flawed and where it was, you know, bogged down in Paul's baggage and a lot of other things, but it never caused me to hate the church. And I think, I guess this needs to be said, I think what concerns me is there are a lot of Urantians who look down upon those people who are sincere of faith, but mired in a church that perhaps embraces a lot of flawed theology, and it's the sincerity of their faith that we have to look at, not the letter of what the tenets of their particular church happen to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd have to agree with you, Lou. Yeah, I look at what are the underpinnings of some people's focusing, you know, on whether somebody's affiliated with a church that is heavily steeped in ecclesiastical authority, whether or not they refer to that, that's probably part of what they may be objecting to. I know that in my own case, the fact that I had to struggle so much in order to get people to understand that I was going off on my own search in adolescence, I mean, what I talked about was a good, accepting attitude in my family that ended about the time I was 13, when I started striking out on my own and started doing my own thing. And had there been more understanding, I doubt that I would have, you know, fallen in that camp, Lou, where I ended up becoming very negative about, you know, things like the Catholic Church and any religion of authority where they presumed to tell you how you were supposed to believe. And it took many years with the Urantia book to settle down and not be automatically, I won't say suspicious, that's not the right word, but automatically in an adversarial stance when the topic of ecclesiastical religion came up. And part of that also had to do with, you know, in my first year and a half with the Urantia book, and I was a teenager at that point still, you know, I was with Church of Christ Christians in British Columbia, and my goodness, you know, I was on fire for the revelation, and just trying to be respectful, trying to take the teachings and live them out and trying to, you know, spoon feed out various truths in the revelation. And these Bible believing Christians would have none of it. I would get smacked down left and right with Bible quotes. And I tried not to do the same thing, you know, with the Urantia quotes.
I think many of us, if not all of us, when we're new to the revelation, are turned on with this almost evangelical zeal where we want to shout it from the rooftops. And then we season and we learn our lessons, you know, we learn our lessons about it's far easier to talk about the good that we overlap with other religions and have in common rather than to pick apart the differences, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hey, guys, I'm going to listen offline now, and it was great to connect with you all again.
Wonderful to hear your voice, Lou. It's so good to have you back with us.
I'll be here. Okay. Thanks for answering my call.
You bet. Thanks for calling.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
So So, you know, there again, you have, you know, Lou's example of the spirituality in children, and this is something that that I know we've talked about in the last couple, both weeks, last week and this week, recognizing that spirituality. You know, he's talking about his faith experience and how hearing that from the nuns, we talked about the nuns last week, it goes both ways, doesn't it? I mean, the nuns can be a force for good, in that they lit him up like a Christmas tree, in his own words. And there's something, you got to give the Catholics and other traditional religions credit for recognizing the spirituality in children and for knowing that children are impressionable and children are naturally hungry for meaning and value. And I think, Miranda, you touched on this too, and how beautiful when somebody recognizes that and actually makes that a part of their daily family life or weekly family life. You know, we know that family meetings are important, and that's a concept that runs throughout the Urantia book. Jesus had family meetings where everybody in the family got to have their say. And I don't know if you do that, Miranda. Do you guys have family meetings?
We do. Once a week we do. Awesome. And, yeah, we start out with basically saying what, you know, praise for what went on in the last week, and then bringing up any problems that we needed to talk about if somebody had gotten in trouble, or we try to let our kids choose their own discipline if they are having issues or have gotten in trouble during the week, and we discuss that as a family. And a lot of times, I mean, the family is, you know, much more merciful. The individual child themselves will decide on a kind of more harsh punishment, and the rest of the family is like, no, we don't, we understand, you know, that you see what you did wrong, and you don't have to have that harsh of a punishment. So it's actually pretty, it turns out pretty sweet.
Can you broach an example so that we can get an idea, a better idea how that looks? What might
like
have happened recently?
So one of our most recent ones was our five-year-old has had issues with his temper, and when the other kids frustrate him or even the two-year-old is picking on him and stuff, he'll have a temper tantrum outburst kind of thing, which sometimes he'll go and hit something or he'll yell at them, and then he has to go take a timeout, cool-off period. So sometimes that comes up in family meeting, and we'll say, you know, Lyndon had kind of a rough week and had quite a few temper tantrums or temper outbursts and had to sit in time out for that. And so we'll talk to Lyndon about why he felt frustrated and what he feels like should happen or would help change his behavior. And he'll say, you know, I should probably be grounded for the week and have to sit in my room after school or something like that. And, you know, then the other kids end up saying, well, no, Lyndon, you know, we love playing with you and we don't want you to have to be away from us, and we want to try to work on what we do that's frustrating you, and so that you don't have to have these angry outbursts, and we feel like you shouldn't have more punishment than what you've already had with your timeouts after each one, so let's just try to have you do better with it this week and not have more punishment than what you've already had. And they'll be like, okay. So it's real sweet that he gets to voice his feelings about why he did that and why he got in trouble. And then he, you know, tries to be harsh on himself about, you know, I feel like I should be punished for the whole next week for failing at that or whatever. And the other kids are like, no, you don't have to. So we have lots of examples of that kind of stuff. But I think my picture of how, you know, when I read the Jesus papers and how Jesus would have done stuff with his family and discuss any problems or people's frustrations together, I think he would have done it sort of the same way. And that's if we never went through that experience of discussing all that kind of stuff as a family and discussing how your behaviors hurt other people's feelings and all that, then I don't think we'd be as close as a family. So I think it's super important for every family to spend that time talking about good stuff, talking about problems, and then we go into one, you know, more guided subject matter that usually has to do with a particular value. And then we talk about how the family can work on that value together over the next week. Yeah. And
how did you initiate this this family ritual of having a family council on a weekly basis? How did you go about starting that with your family?
I just basically said, you know, we're going to do it. And it's something I was raised with. The Mormons are very structured, and this is very important to them. They take every Monday night, so everybody in the entire church on Monday night is having family night, and they combine a structured lesson with talking about family issues and then combine it with something fun at the end, which we do too. So I grew up with it. So for me, it's kind of a natural thing that every family would do, which I know in today's society, many, many families are not doing stuff like this, which is, you know, one of my passions, to try to bring that to the general public and help families become stronger through it. But I definitely wasn't doing it when my children were younger, and I'm not sure how it's very hard during that time period for families, for a couple and their younger children to develop that, because obviously the kids aren't talking yet at first and can't understand these concepts. But maybe even having some way of having family sit-down time, even when children are really little, and husband and wife being able to talk together about everything and then doing something fun and engaging with the children, no matter how little they are, is a good way to start it. But I personally didn't start doing it until my older two were like 4 and 5 years old. And then it was just kind of I think we should start family meetings, like how my family did it, and we just kind of fuddled it from there. But in the last couple of years, it's become a lot more structured now that there are older kids that can really discuss stuff more in depth, and we've started talking about the values and everything a lot more. And I've been so amazed at how well they understand these concepts, and then how they can take it and concentrate on it for a week on this one value, and then they see it in other people and see how they act, and they talk to people at school about it. And it's been amazing to me. They understand stuff in some ways in a depth that I haven't even thought about sometimes. So
here I have an example of two really nice exercises that can be done that teach a spiritual lesson that I didn't, unfortunately, hear about while my children were young, but since then, and it really has touched me that these would be powerful, and it just gets the juices flowing what other exercises might be done to teach a spiritual lesson. The first one is, and I think I've mentioned this on the show before, Renee Vanderpool, who was an elementary school teacher for many, many years in British Columbia. I asked her once, how do you teach kids spiritual concepts? Because she was a longtime Urantia book reader, deeply spiritual person. She said, her kids were 10-year-olds. She said, once every year, I will set up a puzzle in the middle of the room with a piece missing. And as they come into class, they all look at the puzzle, and the first thing they notice is the piece missing. And some of them will come and tell me, the teacher, it's the piece missing. And she said, and she'll say, I know, but we're going to talk about it in a little while. And then she said, at one point, they all gather around the puzzle, and she has the piece in her pocket. And she says, so here's the puzzle. Isn't it nice? What do you all notice? And she says, hands shoot up. The first thing out of everybody's mouth is, there's a piece missing. And she pulls the piece out of her pocket, and in front of them, she puts the piece in, and there's this audible sigh of relief, like, oh. Now it's complete, and she'll hold it up again. She'll take it back out and hold it up and see how much peace you got from the fact that the puzzle was complete because of this piece. But when I show you this piece by itself, it really doesn't look like much, does it? It's a funny shape, it's a funny color, and it doesn't seem to make sense. And yet, if I put it in the puzzle, it makes total sense. And then she points out to them, you are all like this piece of the puzzle. Each one of you has some special contribution to make, and without you, the puzzle is not complete. And she said she's yet to have a 10-year-old that doesn't totally
really get it and really start to appreciate their fellows more as the piece of the puzzle that's essential, and it wouldn't be the same without you. And that's, I think that's a great spiritual lesson. And then the other one that I've heard that I think is really good for even younger children teaches this idea of what we say really hurts, and you know, once it's out, and you can't get it back in. My friend Joanne said recently, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words do permanent damage. And so the lesson is, that words are, that we say are like toothpaste in a tube. And so the exercise I heard is, the fella had his children sit down and take toothpaste. He got them each toothpaste and a stick, a popsicle stick, and had them squeeze the toothpaste out of the tube and then try to put it back in with the popsicle stick. And of course we know you can't get the toothpaste back in the tube. And the lesson is, mm-hmm. words are like that. Once they're out, they're out. You can't take them back. You can't get them back in the tube. It's like toothpaste out of the tube. You can't get it back in. So those are kind of fun. You say you love to have fun with your family. Those are kind of some fun exercises that you can make point with. And there's probably more, too, you know, like that. Similar metaphors that we can use.
Yeah, those are great. And, yeah, we're actually trying to, I mean, I think there's a lot of creative people out there that have developed this kind of stuff, and we've been trying to create an archive that's actually on the Urantia Now website on the family area of just, you know, what have people put together in the last 30, 40 years for their families. There's a family meeting guidebook. There's Sarah Blackstock, she not only knows the Urantia book really well and worked with kids at international conferences, but she also goes to the Unity Church. So she's put together lots of materials that, you know, according to different things that you're trying to teach kids, different activities that go with them. So we're trying to make that accessible for everybody and any, you know, parents or grandparents that are trying to work with children, and especially on spiritual concepts, values concepts, all that kind of stuff, and have it just available where you can look at on Urantia Now and just download any of it for free or print it out. So it's been amazing getting to help with that and getting all the submissions from people and finding all that kind of stuff, because I feel like me, myself, I'm not very creative in coming up with that stuff on my own, but I love using other people's stuff that they have come up with, and I feel that we're so blessed that so many people did put them in writing and publish them, and anybody that hasn't or might have it just sitting around on their shelf, what they used to raise their children and what was helpful for them, sharing that with any of us now is such a blessing. And I hope, you know, that just continues to grow the resources from people. So
we had a woman who came on the air once and a couple years ago, and who I've had some conversations with on Facebook, who was asking if we had any materials for homeschooling kids with the Urantia book values.
Mm-hmm.
And,
remember that.
You know, we don't have anything like that put together in terms of, you know, like a long-term curriculum.
Yeah, we don't right now, but that is what we've been trying to work on. With Truth Seekers, first put together a program for youth as a 5-day retreat kind of program that touches on being a loving person, knowing what forgiveness is, being of service, helping build community, and then goes in depth into values and picking your own individual values to work on and becoming your own individual person and character building. So we're trying to develop it for families now and to where it can be for all ages, using those same concepts, but then expanding on each of the individual values and a lesson of what the Urantia book says about individual values and developing your life in the best way possible. But also, I mean, we've been working on it for the general public as well, because – these concepts cross across every religion and all of parts of humanity, no matter how you're raised. So I think, like Mormons have a lot of resources for their families because they put that as the most important thing and the most important part of society, which is exactly what the Urantia book says too. So the more resources we can have and even, you know, curriculum to help parents that aren't as creative, which I feel like that's what I am, and that's what inspired me to want to develop this more and have a way that I can sit down and read a whole lesson about, you know, a value or a concept, and I can understand it myself, then I can bring it to my family with fun activities and all that kind of stuff. So that is what we're trying to develop. I mean, obviously it's going to take years to get to, you know, something that works for a lot of people. And when you're talking about something for the general public or talking about somebody that truly believes the Urantia book as truth and wants the concepts of that to bring to their family too, you know, it's two different things in some ways, but the bulk of it is still, you know, saying the same thing.
Well, I want to point out before we go any further that you mentioned Sarah Blackstock's work, and Sarah has done quite an amazing body of work. She also was a, and we've had Sarah on the show too. Sarah is the director of a daycare, a very large daycare in Northern California, and she has taught children for 30 years and been responsible for children. And I attended a workshop of Sarah's called Recognizing the Spirituality in Children. It was deeply touching to me because of my own personal experience that I was a very spiritual child and people didn't recognize it. And a lot of her work when I was creating truthbook.com, I put up on the site. And so it is available there, Miranda. I don't know if you knew that, but you can go to truthbook.com/Urantia/parenting and family life and find the body of Sarah's work there. And she has like the Fuel Their Fire, Storytelling, Teaching Truth, Altars, Celebrating Easter, parenting techniques, helping children find and use their abilities. Some wonderful articles and things that Sarah's created are there at truthbook.com for families and parents to be able to help in this respect and get ideas about how to do certain things. And then the other thing I want to mention is that you mentioned Urantia Now, and that's a great, fairly new website that was created by the youth and young adults in the Urantia movement, which my hat's off to you guys. Parenting, you're doing it right now. You're engaged in it. You're deeply engaged in it. If you're not engaged in it, you're coming upon it. It's like Jesus and John Mark on the hillside. Jesus talked to him about family life because he knew that was in his future, in his immediate future, probably within the next several years he would be a parent. It was important for him to know these things. So I'm glad you guys are doing that on Urantia Now. And for our listeners, you can access all of that at www.urantianow.com.
And Truth, and I did know about the Sarah's stuff on Truthbook as well.
Good.
And obviously, I mean, Truthbook was around before Urantia Now even. And I think that, I mean, parents that are Urantia book readers might be looking anywhere and everywhere that they can. So I believe any Urantia site, whether it's the main fellowship one or Truthbook or Urantia Now or Foundation, anywhere, all of them should have a section that says, that at least has other links to other areas where any parent, if they're looking, they can come upon these resources easily and have as much help as they can get. So, yeah, I'm glad
Absolutely.
That they're listed on both.
That's
yeah,
a very good
that
point,
on
Miranda.
The board.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. We need to focus on it, obviously. It's, you know, what these two shows have been about so far is doing just exactly that, creating that spiritual culture within the family, honoring that spirituality, teaching those wonderful, sublime teachings of truth, beauty, and goodness from the Urantia book, giving that to your children. Is it important? Is it not important? I think it is. And Miranda, it sounds like you think it is. Crystal and Andre, I know you both
yeah.
think it is. And what we're trying to do is find ways to do that.
better.
Well,
more
and
effectively.
I think it's important to you know, really kind of get down and dirty and say, like, why is it important to share these values with your kids? You know, why do we do this? You know, my own personal experience was that I had just a much fuller toolbox as a young person than for problem solving than the majority of my peers, because mm-hmm. I had a really strong foundation of faith, and it was not an unreasoned kind of faith. It was a combination of spiritualized thinking and spiritual problem solving. And I don't claim to have been very mature at using these tools early on, but I knew that I had some skills or abilities or understanding that did help me in ways that were pretty significant. One of them was standing up to bullies. Mm-hmm. One of them was being willing to show courage when confronted with something that could have potentially been really scary for other kids. And I think that really came from being steeped in an idea that nothing really permanent could ever hurt me externally. You know, that I was the only one who could really derail my spiritual destiny.
Growth, yeah.
My spiritual growth. And also that sort of evil flourishes when good men do nothing. And that there was an example shown by both of my parents about standing up for truth, beauty, and goodness, and what that looked like. You know, there were a couple of situations in my younger days when my dad was faced with, you know, potential harm because the people in the village didn't like some of his decisions with respect to the hospital he was running. And I remember my mom telling about how they were sending a delegation from the village up to attack my dad. And
nice.
He had been warned by other people that he needed to get out of town. And he refused to go. And he got my brother and me to safety. We were sent to stay with somebody else during that period of time, but he refused to leave. He insisted on facing his accusers. And that show of courage was something that really affected me for the rest of my life. And it went really well. I mean, things didn't turn out very badly. He wasn't physically attacked at all. And but the mere act of standing up to that type of thing, that type of personal attack, was something that really taught me about self-respect.
Well, and what an amazing lesson that was for you. I mean, it reminds me of that quote again that I think we read last night or last week about loyalty. Precept and example are not as profoundly lasting as loyalty. And
mm-hmm.
you know, so it's what you're loyal to as a parent is what your children see. And they understand the difference between what you're loyal to and what you're not loyal to. What you might say, even your example, is not as profoundly influential as that. And so I think that's important.
And I feel like one of the reasons why it's so important to teach values and to put it in a form that's more easily understood, I just felt as a parent that time goes by so fast, and even I felt like I was being a good mother, living a good life, being a good example, but I just felt like time goes by so fast, we're so busy that I didn't have the chance. I felt like they'd be 18 and out of my house, and that, oh my gosh, there's so many things that we never even talked about. Like, they know that I'm an honest person, or they know that I'm loving, but we never had the chance to talk about it. So it just became very important to me to try to lay these out in a way that now I know by the time they turn 18, we've discussed at least 50 values, and we've learned how to live them, and we've had in-depth discussions, and they know they can come to me with struggles about each one of these individually and all that kind of stuff. And it just, once I started developing it and putting it in a way that was easier for me to bring up the subjects and talk to the kids more in depth about them, I felt better as a parent, or I felt like, you know, I'm gonna be able to do my job okay and know that we at least talked about these and touched on them and why they're important and why their life is going to be better if they decide to foster these things in their life. And, I mean, it helped me feel better as a parent. And then once we started doing it, it just made our family so much stronger, so much we're able to communicate so much better and just have such more in-depth discussions. So it was, you know, proof that kind of stuff is so important. And
it sounds too like it really fosters trust within your family mm-hmm. itself too.
Yeah, and accountability. Like, they know my top values of what I personally want to work on each day, and I tell them, you know, if I'm, you know, not being gentle and cheerful in the face of, you know, a bunch of stress, you know, feel free to remind me, or we can talk about that, or what, you know, I can share with you why I felt like I didn't, you know, uphold my values that I'm trying to work on most, and I, you know, want to think about how we can do it differently next time, and how we can work on that kind of stuff. And they see me work on it as well as, you know, them work on this stuff too, and they were very open and honest about that, and that we're not perfect, and it becomes almost like a game instead of being so harsh on yourself, and you're able to laugh at your, you know, human tendencies or your tendencies of what you grew up with or were raised with or the people that are around you. And then you can, you know, find ways of being gently supportive of each other and seeing that we're not perfect, but that's like the fun in it. So that it's become cool, you know, like working on values and being a more loving person is almost like a game, and they know, you know, the kids can see that if you are learning to master the game and learn, you know, the ways of doing it, that it brings you so much more joy in your life and helps your relationships and helps you get along with others and all this. They have the experiences that show them that it's worth doing.
Make it
fun.
And
it sounds very practical.
Yeah, and you know, I want to say too, just from my experience, if you have these open and honest conversations, and one of the ways I did this with my children is I would select a movie. We're all movie buffs. We love movies. But it wasn't enough to just watch the movie. We would watch the movie, and I oftentimes would screen it first to make sure that it had some value in it that I really wanted to talk about with my children. We would watch it, and then we would discuss it. And we would discuss it in depth. We would have a real meaningful conversation. It's something I still share with my adult children now. They'll watch them. They'll call me to discuss it immediately. Mom, did you see that? Wow, what did you think? you know, what was the point of that? And, you know, we'll have these great discussions about this movie, whatever it was. And what occurs to me is when your kids, you know, when your 2-year-old needs you a lot, I mean, you know, you've got to watch, you almost have to hover over them to make sure that they don't get into any dangerous situation. Well, what occurs to me is teenagers are like that too. They have just enough free will and freedom to be dangerous, and not advertently. They don't mean to be dangerous, but they are. And you, as a wise parent, really recognizes that. And you also recognize that you won't be there to help them make decisions, because they're going to have other influences in their life. They're going to have other kids who try to get them to do drugs or whatever it is. And you want to give them an education, and getting to your point, Miranda, of discussing this stuff. And even, you know, they'll be gone and I won't be able to discuss this. That's true while they're still living under your roof. Because when they get old enough, they're out being influenced by others and you don't have any control over that. And they're experimenting with their ability to choose and decide. And you want to give them as many tools for their toolbox, as Crystal said, to make intelligent decisions or to have enough self-esteem to say, you know what, no, I don't need to do that. Or I don't necessarily think that's a good idea. Or maybe I'd like to talk this over with my family. Or, you know, some way to make good decisions. It's absolutely invaluable. And even beyond that, I'd like to pray about this.
Yeah, I'd like to have a chat with my Father in heaven.
Right. They may not say that to their friends, but wouldn't we all be delighted if they felt like they loved God and knew God well enough to say to themselves, I want to chat about this with the Father in heaven. I want to get some inner guidance here. And so, you know, I love your point about that. Making it fun is a great point, too. And Crystalline, you always say that your dad did that. But we have a couple of callers who've been holding for a while, and I'd like to put them on as well. Miranda, you're welcome to stay on with us. Love your contributions. Thank you so much. This is Ron Hammer from California. Hi, Ron. How you doing?
Real good. Real good, Paula. A couple of thoughts came to my mind as I forgot the other guest that's been sharing some wonderful ideas with the family. And one thing that I have shared with a number of people on the expression was used timeouts. And
Ron, you have your computer turned up. You need to turn
it
on.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We
I'm
can hear
sorry.
It in the background.
Yeah, hang
no
on
problem.
Here. Hang on. Is that
much better? Guess,
yeah, I'm yeah. sorry. I got my hearing aids turned off, so I don't hear that. Sorry. But about timeouts, and Russell, he is raising 3 children, and he was definitely, it put Rusty, his youngest one, in timeout, go to your room in timeout, stuff like that. And I told Russell, I said, Russell, have you ever thought about the dynamics of punishing, if that would be the right expression, restricting your son by having him go to his room? Ask him how he views his room. Because most people, I remember when I was a child, my room was like my sanctuary. And to go into my sanctuary for punishment was a...
not effective?
It would not necessarily affect anyway. It was desecrating the room.
Oh.
And so I asked him, instead of punishing him with something like that, ask him what he thought would be a good place to have, maybe sit in a chair or sit in a pantry or something else. And so he talked to his boys about it, and he called me up afterwards and said, Ron, you know, really appreciate your suggestion because I have no idea the impact that using that area of their personal being for such a negative purpose, how they really just were disgruntled about it, he mentioned. And they really were appreciative that Dad took the time to ask him about that and be able to come to a resolved area that was acceptable. And yet they realized the purpose of it too. And so when I'm like, well, I get in there, I get to, you know, play all my toys or everything else, you know. And so I wanted to share that point with the listeners here. It might be of value. And, you know, many times we hear people say, I have quality time with my children. I'm busy, but the time I have with them is quality time. And in reality, to have the quality time, those gems of moments of communication and intimacy with them, is only produced when we have abundance of quantity time. In reality,
that is so true.
And quality is, you know, and what from what I've heard over the years is one-on-one time with each child, being able to spend time with them one-on-one without any other influence kind of affecting. And Andre, I think you mentioned that last week, that you went out into nature with your child, with each one, and you had a special experience with them out in nature. And I think that's so important to have that one-on-one time. That's really quality.
I had a friend of mine, he's dead now, he's a wise old man, and he raised 10 boys or 10 children. And on Christmas and on their birthdays, they got their normal presents, but he gave each one a redeemable coupon that he had. This is with the child's name on it, and says, this is redeemable for Joanne to have one day on any weekend of her choice to have totally with Papa and to do whatever she wishes to do. And of all the gifts, That was the one that they all, I've talked with the children, and they say, you know, that was the most ecstatic event and gifts that we always looked for. So in such great anticipation in those times of the year. And, they'd use it later on. But as you just mentioned, that one-on-one time is so valuable. And as to the self-esteem, like your illustration you used, Paula, about the toothpaste and words, and how the need to be focused on. So often we say things, even that we shut down our emotions, our children's emotions, and we call it feeling stoppers, and where, like, let's say, the child is saying, I'm angry. He says, oh, no, Johnny, you don't feel like that. And so you're shutting down his emotions. So say, wow, tell me more. Why are you angry?
Why are you angry? What are you feeling?
Yeah, right. You have that because spirit is a lot of emotions, you know, and connecting the body and society, though, shuts it down. So often in school, we get like 400 negative statements every 10 positive statements a day. Or like, let's say, Johnny hit me, like, you know, well, what did you do to him? You know, instead of saying, wow, yeah, I don't. And to draw him out in conversation,
right.
You know. And that's the key thing. There's so many simple things that we do, unfortunately, and yet there's such a simple twist that creates the openness. I never forget Pat Boone. He raised 5 girls, and he was on the Johnny Carson show. And Johnny was asking him, "Have any problems of raising those girls, man? You must, you know, had a handful of any situations that might be able to share with the audience." And he said, "Well, I was playing with my daughter such and such, and we were playing on the badminton court in the backyard, hitting it back and forth. And here I am hitting the badminton back and forth. And out of the blue, she says, 'You know, Dad, I think I'm the only virgin in high school.'" And he tried to act nonchalant, you know, hit the bat, the 30 back to her. Oh, really? Well, how do you feel about that, honey? You know? And yet, he had that ability to draw his daughter out in such a intimate conversation, in such an environment of just the two of them. And as he shared that that experience, there was such a teaching tool to the audience for the parents, and having the child, having a teenager, having that freeness of speech to talk to their parents in such a way like that. It's so beautiful.
Right. It is. We have another caller holding, so Ron, you're hold on with us here if you like.
Anyway.
We're getting a reverb again.
Too. I'm going to let you
yeah,
go.
Yeah, we may have too many people on the line right at the moment. How's that? We there?
Hello?
Oh, we may have had somebody knocked off.
We may have actually gotten knocked off ourselves. Paula, are you still on? Yeah,
listeners,
we definitely,
you may want to give us feedback on the board to let us know who it is you're still hearing. This is Andre and Crystalline here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm sure Paula will be calling back in. That's very interesting that we're still on.
Hey, you guys, can you hear me?
Yeah, we sure
can.
You can
now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
There was something on the board. It just took a long time for that call to drop off. I'm not sure really why that happened, but I think it just caused a problem here. And with us should be another 303 caller.
Miranda, are you still there?
Are you talking to me?
No, yeah. Ron's still there.
No, that's a new voice.
Hi, new voice. Who is this?
This is David Beek.
Hi, David.
Oh, hello, David.
Hi there, brother.
Howdy.
Well, you got caught in a time warp there.
Yeah, right. It's not easy to discern that your call has been picked up. Anyway, so apologize if that was me who caused the problem.
No, it was a technical problem that we were having on the line. It didn't have anything to do with your call.
Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to share, in addition to all the great spiritual values and techniques and ways of thinking about all of this that are all extremely useful and valuable, a thing I wanted to share is what we've encountered in our family is just that regardless of what we want to be able to do and what we understand intellectually, we're just not able to accomplish that because of either not really understanding how to get from point A to point B or because there are emotional blocks in the way. And actually, when we listened to Margaret Paul on your show a while ago, that sort of inspired us to think about pursuing the inner bonding process, which really didn't resonate well for us. But in the meantime, found something that we like even better and has been very eye-opening with regard to how you can sort of understand some of these blocks and find the tools to actually accomplish and put into play the values that you're trying to incorporate into your lives. We're a little bit in the early stages of that, but I think that what you had on your program from Margaret Paul about, you know, that the inner bonding process kind of being primary and necessary in order to, you know, be able to have these effective relationships, which, you know, you sort of need to have an effective relationship within yourself first before you're really able to have an effective relationship with others. And that probably also includes, you know, God and the other spiritual beings that that we depend on in our lives. I don't know. But I've been kind of excited about learning some new things and realizing.
Is there anything you can share with us about what that process has been like?
Well, Kristen, before you say that, why don't you tell our listeners who David is in relation to you?
This is my younger brother,
you.
David.
Yeah, and David has two children, Sydney and Nathaniel, and they're what, 8 and 5 or
almost 10 and 8.
10 and 8. Oh boy, was I off. and a little story about
feed them and they grow.
We had a worship service, and David's children were sitting in the audience, and we were talking about, Andre, in fact, was talking about family and how much family means, and he said something to the effect of who in the audience has perfect parents, and in the back row, two little hands shot up without hesitation, and it was David's children. And it was really touching.
No,
it was endearing.
If you buried them today, you might get a different response.
Yeah. But I love that you brought up Margaret Paul and inner bonding. And Kristen, I think, asked you for an example of...
you're using now, yeah.
Yeah, they're using... You have found a new tool that is
right.
Seems to be working well, and I thought maybe you could share with us what that was or how it worked.
Well, just exploring this new tool has certainly pointed out the degree to which we are not perfect parents. And and really, I think, highlighted for us a lot of what the struggles are. You know, we know that our children need certain things from us, and we just don't know how to give that to them. We know they need guidance. We know they need help. We can see that they're struggling with issues, and we just don't have any tools that we've learned. You know, there isn't any kind of parenting book that you can go to that will tell you how to do these things and do them effectively. And a lot of the things that we learned from our parents or from other people in our lives just don't work. So being able to come up with things that really do work, you know, to some degree, they are ultra simple. An example is, you know, not giving your kids advice unless they ask for it, which is from the Urantia book, and Jesus, you know, exemplified that, and here's child rearing techniques, but putting that into practice, or really only focusing on the positive, you know, is a lot harder to do in practice than it is in theory. And it's especially hard to do when you don't have control over the things that are driving you internally, emotionally, that you don't have control over. And sometimes those, even though you may be saying the right words, your intention and your emotional internal judgments are still going to come through to your children and defeat the best of intentions. So I think, you know, we're really just embarking on this journey now in earnest. But the psychological model that we've been following is called internal family systems theory.
Mm.
And seems really promising and exciting, and I'm sure I can't do it justice at all, but my understanding of it is that if you think of your own self as being made up of different people, different parts, different personalities, and they sometimes play well together and sometimes they don't. And sometimes one part will kind of bully another or take over or manage, you know, particularly managers who shut down the scared child, and then that child rebels and you know, it almost sounds a bit crazy, except when you realize that it actually works and that there is some, apparently some brain physiology science that confirms this, that when there are changes made in the internal family system, that there are physical changes that happen in the brain that coincide with that. And it's as if the same kind of techniques that work with interpersonal relationships also work with intrapersonal relationships, and that, you know, you need to learn how to listen to yourself and be kind to yourself. And I'm sure everyone has heard the expression of, you know, stop beating yourself up about that. You know, I mean, that's sort of a literal example of one part of yourself, you know, beating up another part, which literally happens, I guess, if you believe this particular model. And just seems like it's a very potent technique for really understanding a lot of the internal dynamics that each of us deal with that have direct implications for our relationships with all of our loved ones and, well, really everyone in our lives. So I'm sure there are other equally valid, you know, approaches that you might try. Although I have tried quite a few in my life. My system is better. I think in theory it's very similar to what Margaret Paul was talking about, the inner bonding, just a little slightly different.
Well, and it sounds like it's kind of a more practical application, or definitive application. I mean, a lot of the things, the tools out there for learning how to deal with unresolved issues are talked about or written about in very theoretical ways.
Mm. And would be difficult to talk to children about.
Yeah.
Whereas
right.
I think that what my hope is that we can kind of develop a common language around this internal family systems dialogue, you know, with our children, and then they can begin to have insight into, oh, well, when mommy does this, it's because of this, and it makes me feel like this. And when daddy does this, you know, that is because of this, and that makes him feel like this, and it, you know, makes me feel like this, and that triggers this in me. And, you know, I think that it actually is very immediate and very primary and is not as intellectual as I'm making it sound, but more, you know, more of a, well, it's really
more
having
understanding.
It's based in a knowledge of relationships, really,
right?
And that's really what you're talking about, and as you said, everything in the Urantia book, everything in the universe has to do with interpersonal relationships, and, you know, our relationship with God, our relationship with other people has everything to do with spirituality. It's at the center of it. And so the more we can understand how relationships work and how to make relationships more effective, that seems to be consistent with a spiritual path at a very primary level.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, we have one more caller, and I'd like to put him back on. It's Lou. He wants to share a story with us. So, David, hang on here with us. We don't have that much time, if you can. And we'll put Lou back on. Lou, you're back on with us, brother.
Thanks, Paula, and I know we're running out of time. I'll try to be brief. I am reminded of a child psychologist that I heard speak on NPR many, many years ago, and I never forgot her lecture. It's a story of two fathers and two sons, and it just it bears the point out that the reaction of the parent to the child has a great deal to do with the outcome of the situation. The first father walks into his garage and he sees his son playing a guitar very loudly, and the son stops and he says, "Dad, I want to become a rock star. I'm not going to go to college." And the father blows his top. He has a fit and he says, "Like heck you are. Your mother and I worked really hard. You're going to college and you're going to get a degree and you're going to go to grad school and you're going to be a professional and none of this rock star junk." And he storms out of there. And the son is obviously filled with deep hurt and resentment. And if he doesn't run away from home to follow his dreams, he's at least stung very badly. The second situation is pretty much the same thing. A father walks into his garage, and he sees his son playing a guitar very loudly. The son stops playing, and the son says, "Dad, I think I want to be a rock star. I'm going to drop out of school and follow my dream." And the father, in this case, says, "Son, that's great. I think it's wonderful that you have dreams. I want to encourage you to follow them. If there's anything I can do to help you along the way, just let me know." And he walks out. And the way the psychologist ended the second story is she said, the son didn't drop out of school. He went on to college. But the point is he was affirmed and reinforced in his personhood that his dream wasn't immediately squashed down by some adults who thought they knew better. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even if the adults do perceive the dream to be harebrained and reckless, the point is, I think that many times not only do we need to support our children's dreams, but we need to give them a little bit of latitude of personal freedom where they can make their own mistakes and learn their own lessons. That's all I've got to say.
And I think
that's great, Lou.
That speaks to the heart of, you know, don't force a ready-made experience on them. Allow them the freedom to have an experience of their own and to follow their own dream. And it reminds me of my own dad telling me once when I was 18, I had some harebrained idea that I was going to do, and I had at least the good sense to talk it over with him. And he was a very wise man. And he told me, he said, "You know, I can't forbid you to do that, from doing that." He said, "You're old enough to make your own decisions now. But if I could, I would." That's all he said. And that, him putting it squarely back on me, man, I'll tell you what, I really thought about that. I thought about that harder than if he had said, "No, Paul, you can't do this. I forbid you from doing this." I probably would have rebelled. But the fact that he told me, "I can't forbid you from doing that. You're old enough to decide for yourself. But if I could, I would." Man, yeah. That had an impact on me.
That's good parenting. You know, that's good parenting.
Yeah, he was a good parent.
I'm trying to get into the habit of asking my children if they want my advice about something, because I think, again, that is, and sometimes they say no, and, you know, that's...
Do they ever say yes?
They do, yeah.
Aww. That's pretty impressive.
That's proactive, too. Ask them if they want your advice. There's no rule against that.
Well, I mean, you know, I think we do have to be very careful not to give advice, and it's really difficult as a parent to resist that temptation, because we want to do everything we can to help them.
You know, the arrangement was very clear about this prescription of not giving advice unless it's asked for, but I think the only glaring exception would be parents of young children. I think you have to step in.
You do, because they don't have the experience and they can't see the train wreck coming, you know. I mean,
yeah.
And you can. And so if you said nothing and then they got into a bad situation, then you'd feel bad for, you know, forever about that. So you have to say something.
Well, I think that there's a time in your child's life where it becomes, I mean, for most parents, I think they know when that is, but maybe not. When they sort of really become more sentient beings.
Yes.
And before that age, then intervention is pretty necessary just to keep them alive till they reach the age of being a sentient being.
Mm-hmm. There was a presidential candidate, I think it might have been the 92 election, named Heather Ann Harder. She was from Indiana. And actually, her name has showed up on some of these Urantia databases. And one thing she said in her campaign speech, I went to see her twice, she said the worst thing a parent can do is to protect the child from the consequences of his actions. So at some point, you have to let them learn the lesson. And maybe if your son, got into a fender bender because he was drinking beer, maybe he should spend a night in jail. It's not going to kill him. You know, he shouldn't get bailed out immediately. Maybe he should think about what it was that he did. You know, we're so quick to overly protect. This is a very coddled generation of children, let me tell you. And, I said, actions have consequences and they need to experience them.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And there are good consequences to not shielding from consequences. I can think of one really good one where someone I know was not shielded from the consequences at age 16, which I was curious from Miranda, what her stepdaughter might be going through, or her adopted daughter. Because that's a tough age for girls. And when that had been gone through and the parents did not shield her from the consequences, the legal consequences of what she'd done, that girl went on to get a scholarship, full ride scholarship to school. So, those kinds of things can happen, and it's really, really important to allow kids to work through the consequences of their own actions.
So true. You can't overprotect them, and I think Jesus gave John Mark that very example, that his friend Amos was overprotected, and it led to a consequence that wasn't very desirable, whereas John Mark, whose parents were more willing to let him go out and have an adventure with Jesus and the apostles, actually got to spend time in the presence of our universe sovereign and learn from him, and even spent that historic day on the hill alone with him and had his direct advice about family life. So that's another good example, Andre, of, he wasn't shielded from the consequences, and the consequences were actually quite astounding and quite wonderful.
Yeah.
We have to have faith, and we have to teach our children to have faith, I think, that good things can happen too, not only bad things. We get so...
I don't know.
Worried, I guess, as parents. We have to have faith.
We're getting a lot of feedback.
Yeah, they've got thought
again.
Adjusters after all, don't they? That's something that we can't underscore enough. The revelation teaches us that we all have that inner guide. We all have the Spirit of Truth. We all have the Holy Spirit. We all have angels, whether personal angelic guardians or group guardians. And, with all those spiritual tools at our disposal, though, there are times where grave mistakes are made, the fact is that we still are lovingly guided as far as we can go. And even when consequences look terrible from our end, we should trust in the fact that God ultimately has all things in hand.
There you go. And we are down to our last minute and a half. I went ahead and put David Beek and Lou on hold. I don't think you guys had a whole lot more to say, but I do want to thank you for calling in and sharing your ideas and your thoughts with us. Miranda, thank you for calling. Ron Hammer, thank you for calling. This has been a great show today. I really enjoyed it, and I got a lot out of it, and I hope you did too, listeners. Got some new ideas and some new thoughts about how to share spirituality and deep
concepts and values with children, divine values with them, how to honor their spirituality and recognize it. And we're down to the last minute. So, Krislyn and Andre, did you have anything you wanted to add before we end today?
Well, I would like to just invite all of our listeners to stay tuned for the next week or so as we continue this series, and to please call in and write to us or send us messages to let us know if you'd like us to take the discussion in a particular direction. And we invite you to call in to 646-716-8158 next week, same time, same station.
Yeah. And you're listening to The Cosmic Citizen. And we will be back with more on family and creating a spiritual culture in the family next week. So until then, I guess we'll just say bye for now.
Bye for now.
Bye for now, everyone.
God bless.
God bless.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.